You are listening to KBOO FM in Portland. Coming up next, the KBOO Evening News, followed by Free Speech Radio News and We the People.
KBOO FM, Portland, power to people.
The rule of law. Since the Magna Carta, the idea that the will of the rulers can be bound by law seemed like a pretty good one. On Thursday, February 26th, at 6 p.m., We the People will address war crimes and impunity. Should the Bush administration be held accountable for possible war crimes? What are the obligations of the Obama administration to restore the rule of law? Join us for a call-in show where we'll explore these questions. We'll also have an interview with Chuck Sedetik, co-author of Madam Prosecutor, Confronting Jimenez's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity, and Francis Boyle, University of Illinois law professor and internationally recognized expert on international law and human rights. Call us with your questions or comments, or post them before and after the show at www.kboo.fm/we the people. Just because the president does it, it doesn't mean it's not illegal.
Friday, March 6th, Headlock Music, Rough Cuts Clothing, and KBOO Community Radio welcome the fireman Anthony B. to Portland, live and direct, straight out of Jamaica, for a night of conscious roots and dancehall reggae. Doors at 8, show starts at 9, with Don Dignitaries, J. Ross Pirelli, and the Escort Service Band. Small Axe Sound with YT and MC Jaga are in the house as well. All this at Barbati's downtown at Southwest 3rd and Ankeny. A portion of the proceeds of this 21 and over event will benefit KBOO Community Radio. Yes, Anthony B.
I'm Lena Aliyaloro.
This is Scott Fink.
This is Linda Orphanostin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nay.
I'm Robert Barncourt.
Volunteer run, community powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a look at unemployment figures released today for the state of Oregon.
Federal money may not be enough to cover Oregon's gap in education spending.
And defendants await a verdict in Oregon's charities challenged to warrantless wiretapping.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 26th, 2009. I'm Maggie Starr.
And I'm Sun Lee. The U.S. Justice Department has asked the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for an emergency stay in a trial brought against the government by an Oregon charity. The Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation, which was targeted by the Bush administration for alleged involvement in terrorism, was found not guilty and went on to file a lawsuit against the government. The ruling could come as early as Friday in the long legal battle by the charity. The case began when the Bush administration accidentally turned over documents to Al-Haramain attorneys during the original lawsuit against the charity. The lawyers for Al-Haramain said the paper showed illegal wiretapping by the National Security Agency. They then filed a case against the U.S. government to challenge warrantless wiretapping by the Bush administration. Unlike most of the cases brought against Bush, this was granted standing by the courts and was allowed to move forward. The Obama administration continues to invoke the state secret privilege. Al-Haramain's attorneys say that this continued obstruction by the new administration shows that Obama is attempting to avoid other similar lawsuits by the use of wiretaps in violation of the law.
The Oregon Education Association said today that the state legislature's announcement of a school restoration fund made up of federal stimulus money only tells half the story. In collaboration with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Sam Theobald has more.
Democrats in the Oregon legislature want to use $51 million federal stimulus dollars to keep public schools from having to close early this year. They're calling it the School Restoration Fund. The largest teachers union in the state says what they're not mentioning, that they're also proposing $54 million worth of cuts. With that in mind, Oregon Education Association's VP Gail Rasmussen says there's no need for state lawmakers to give the federal money a special name. or take credit for it.
In calling it a restoration fund, so it looks like something is being done for schools. This money was already allocated to schools. Now it appears that districts are going to have to jump through hoops to get the money that was already designated for them.
Rasmussen says there's already a formula for allocating money by district, and schools shouldn't have to do more paperwork to justify receiving federal funds. She says most already cut staff and programs when the education budget was cut by $61 million in December. Republicans in the legislature predict the federal dollars still won't be enough to keep all schools open for a normal school year.
That was KBOO's Sam Theobald in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Oregonians may soon be able to find the state's revenue and spending information online. There's currently a bill in the Oregon House to create a searchable website for that information. The Department of Administrative Services is supporting the bill. Other backers are hoping the website can be created for little or no cost. The House Rules Committee will hear the bill again in a few weeks. If it passes, Oregon would join 12 other states in posting some or all of their spending information online.
A former University of Portland student is suing the school for failing to tell police that she reported a rape. The student was 16 when she enrolled in the university, and she alleges that she was raped in a men's dormitory that same year. The student said she later told a faculty member and the university's public safety department. Her lawsuit claims that the administration violated a state law requiring them to report sexual assaults on minors.
The state of Oregon released new unemployment figures today. The figures show that Oregon lost almost 15,000 jobs in January, which brings the unemployment rate to 9.9%. KBOO's Liam Delta has more on where these numbers come from and what they mean.
The unemployment rate provides a good overall indicator of how the economy is treating the labor force, but it washes over a lot of details. To calculate the unemployment rate, economists divide the number of Oregonians who are looking for jobs by the total number in the labor force. They define the labor force as everyone who has a job or is looking for one. That ends up leaving out a lot of people, like homemakers, retirees, and anyone who isn't applying for work. There are just under 4 million people living in Oregon, but only about 2 million are considered to be in the labor force. When the federal government gathers its data for national unemployment, it pulls in survey data from across the country. It has enough people in its surveys that it can extrapolate from the surveys to a rate for the national labor force. Oregon is smaller, though, and can't rely only on survey data. David Cook is an economist with the Employment Department.
The unemployment rate data is based on a series of inputs like unemployment insurance claims data, this current employment statistics data, and also data from a household survey called the Current Population Survey. And those numbers are put into a model to estimate how many people are employed and unemployed and not in the labor force.
Once they pull their data together, they start crunching the numbers. It's not just a matter of simple division, though. They also adjust the numbers depending on the season.
If you have data for the number of jobs in construction each month going back 10 or 20 years, you're going to see many more people working in construction in the summer months and fewer in the winter. And you can feed data into a computer system so you can see what the expected amount of the highs in the summer and the lows in the winter are going to be, and then you could take those out. The advantage in using the seasonally adjusted data is you can compare employment over different time periods that don't happen to be at the same time of the year. For example, we can look at construction numbers right now, and if we look at the seasonally adjusted construction numbers, see that construction employment is down by about 10,000 jobs since the summer, taking into consideration the normal fluctuations. But if you just looked at the not seasonally adjusted numbers, the January numbers would be a lot lower because they're always lower in January compared to July.
A seasonally adjusted unemployment rate gives a better idea of how the economy is doing. But in the summer, it overstates the number of people who are actually without jobs, and in the winter months, it understates that number. That means that more than 10% of the Oregon labor force is without a job right now, but the employment department expects some of them to be reemployed in the summer. Of course, the unemployment rate is not the same for all sectors of the economy or for all sectors of the labor force. Oregon can't collect as much data as the federal government, so it doesn't do these more detailed analyses. A closer look, though, reveals a more nuanced picture of the labor force. Tim Dewey is an economics professor at the University of Oregon and director of the Oregon Economic Forum.
On a national basis, you can dig into this data on a much deeper level, including broader measures of unemployment, ones that include persons who are part-time for economic reasons, right? And so these people are technically employed, but would rather be full-time employed rather than part-time employed. And those measures of unemployment, when you include those, give you a significantly higher unemployment rate, close to 14% for the nation.
Digging even deeper, Dewey can see who are losing their jobs fastest and who are holding on to them. Nationally, he points out, workers with more education are doing better.
There's differences in unemployment rates relative to education levels. Persons with college educations have a significantly lower unemployment rate than individuals who have no high school. I don't think that comes as much of a surprise. What might be more of a surprise is in this downturn, we've seen the rate of change really different between those groups. Persons who have a college education have, in fact, suffered higher unemployment rates, but persons with no high school have suffered much, much higher changes in unemployment rates. And that would suggest that this downturn, in fact, has had a disproportionate effect on persons with lower levels of education.
Oregon's 9.9% unemployment rate may be the headline of the day, but there are more stories hiding in the numbers. For KBOO News, I'm Liam Delta for Maggie Starr.
Today, Washington announced they will collect $11 million from tobacco companies in a 10-year-old lawsuit. The original lawsuit pitted states against tobacco companies. The tobacco companies have agreed to transfer the money to Washington, pending the resolution of a payment dispute with the states. Washington's attorney general sued the tobacco companies a second time in 2006 for not making agreed-upon annual payments. The annual payments were in part to compensate for health care costs associated with tobacco-related diseases.
Mutinous Bangladeshi border guards ended their two-day revolt today. This put to rest concerns that revolt would spread across the South Asian nation. Nearly 2,000 guards opened fire on their senior officers and seized their headquarters to protest poor pay and conditions. At least 18 people were killed in the insurrection. The guards agreed to surrender after the government promised to give them amnesty and look into their demands. The insurrection resulted from the guards' longtime frustration over pay. Border guards were paid less than the Bangladeshi army. The guards were also worried about rising food prices. The guards make about $100 a month.
The Obama administration has ended the ban on photos of soldiers' coffins returning home from Iraq. Today, Defense Secretary Robert Gates essentially said it is up to the families of the deceased soldiers whether they will allow media coverage in each individual case. The ban on news coverage of the coffins of soldiers killed in the war goes back to 1991 and the first Gulf War. Then-President George H.W. Bush started the ban, which prevented the media from taking pictures of the coffins of dead soldiers returning from Iraq. The government continued the policy through the Clinton and Bush Jr. administrations. It said that photos of the soldiers' remains would have an adverse impact on the public support for U.S. wars.
In Iraq today, two Iraqi soldiers were killed and 12 others were wounded in a roadside bombing in Baghdad. Iraqi officials say the morning blast struck an Iraqi army patrol near the University of Baghdad in the central part of the city. Also today, four bodyguards of the Iraqi parliament members were arrested for their connection to a rogue Iraqi official. The official in question is accused of ordering the bombing of the Iraqi parliament that took place in April 2007. Also, the U.S. Army has confirmed that First Lieutenant William Emmert, 36, of Fayetteville, Tennessee, was killed in action in Mosul, Iraq, on Tuesday. And on Wednesday evening, in the Ilam district in southern Iraq, a roadside bomb exploded near a police patrol, wounding six people, including two policemen and four civilians.
Puerto Rico has found an unlikely solution for its surplus of wild monkeys. It's going to ship them to Iraq. About a dozen Pattus monkeys that had pillaged farms in the island's southwest will fly across the Atlantic in upcoming weeks, courtesy of the Baghdad Zoo. The U.S. colony of Puerto Rico is eager to get rid of the estimated 2,000 monkeys that have escaped from research centers over the last 30 years. Puerto Rican officials say that they have been pleading with zoos across the world to accept the monkeys. Officials continue to capture some monkeys and shoot others, a method they consider more humane than lethal injection.
The British government admitted today that British forces had participated in rendition. The nation's defense secretary told lawmakers Thursday that the transfers did occur, contrary to previous government assurances. He apologized for the error. The secretary says the two are still being held in Afghanistan, and the U.S. has given assurances that they are being held in a, quote, humane, safe, and secure environment, end quote. Officials have known about the case for years, but never told Parliament or the public. In fact, the British government repeatedly denied participating in renditions. The defense secretary said that the men were sent to Afghanistan because there were no relevant translators in Iraq. This admission by Britain comes shortly after a British resident was released from Guantanamo Bay prison.
The first insurgent from the Iraq War, prosecuted in U.S. courts today, admitted to planting roadside bombs. His plea deal carries a 25-year sentence, but the Netherlands will decide how much time he spends in prison. Iraqi-born Dutch citizen Wissam Al-Dalima said that he and his fellow resistance fighters planted remote-control explosives along a road used by U.S. troops. The explosives did not cause any deaths. Al-Dalima pleaded guilty in U.S. federal court to conspiracy to murder Americans outside the United States. The charge can carry a sentence of up to life in prison and a $250,000 fine. Al-Dalima could end up with a lighter sentence because the agreement also says he will be returned to the Netherlands, where a Dutch judge will determine how much time he should serve. The court did not bring up the internationally recognized right of a people to resist foreign military occupation of their country. 2 years ago, the Dutch government agreed to his extradition with the condition that he be tried in a civilian court, not a military tribunal. In 2003, an interview broadcast on Dutch television, Al-Dalima accused the U.S. and its allies of waging a war in Iraq to control its oil reserves.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, 4,251 U.S. soldiers have been killed since the U.S. invasion began in 2003. Over 31,000 soldiers have been wounded, many of them disabled for life. The exact number of Iraqis killed is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by We the People, a show which explores the current state of human rights and civil liberties in America. Tomorrow's weather is patchy freezing fog before 10 a.m., partly sunny, with a high near 47.
And now it's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Let's talk pills. To treat everything from allergies to heart problems, half of Americans take a prescription medicine every day, and nearly all of us reach for the pill bottle on occasion. It's perfectly safe, though, because the Food and Drug Administration regulates the ingredients that go into those medicinal compounds, right? Yes, assuming they're produced in the USA. Aren't they? Mostly, no. Take antibiotics. The New York Times reports that ingredients for the majority of these bacteria fighters are now made almost exclusively in China and India, as are the components of dozens of other major drugs. Unbeknownst to most Americans and to our doctors, China has become the world's preeminent supplier of medicines. As one major drug company puts it, if tomorrow China stopped supplying pharmaceutical ingredients, the worldwide pharmaceutical industry would collapse. What's at work here is mindless globalization and deregulation. Our politicians threw open the U.S. market to drug imports while also letting foreign manufacturers go uninspected and unregulated. So, companies located in China can cut corners and undercut our own regulated pill makers. America's last producer of penicillin's ingredients, for example, shut down in 2004, leaving us dependent on China. FDA, our supposed watchdog, doesn't even know where a drug's ingredients come from. Why? Because drug companies say they don't like to reveal their sources, so they don't.
The Times found that one federal database lists the existence of about 3,000 foreign drug plants that ship to the U.S., while another lists 6,800. No one knows which is correct, if either. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is ridiculous. For the sake of America's health, security, and economy, let's regulate all pill makers and rebuild our own industry.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
There have been at least 10 medical marijuana raids this week in Mendocino County, California. According to local residents, many of the raids have targeted families with children. They say the children have been taken in to state custody. Those targeted say they are complying with county and state laws governing medical marijuana. Proponents of medical marijuana say raids have increased in number and severity since President Obama took office. They have called on him to put an end to the raids, and Obama has not yet taken a stand on the issue, which pits federal agents against state law in California, Oregon, and several other states.
A group calling itself the Robin Hoods has claimed responsibility for distributing stolen food to a working-class neighborhood in Modesto, California. They said they were inspired to carry out this action by the recent case of a 48-year-old man from the area who was arrested for stealing $100 worth of groceries. The group distributed the food in public places with a banner reading, "Resist the Recession, Rob the Rich." They did not indicate where they had obtained the food other than that it had been stolen. The food included rice, beans, and other staples, which were quickly distributed among people living in the neighborhood.
Colorado's oldest paper, the Rocky Mountain News, will print its last edition tomorrow, after 150 years in circulation. In recent years, the paper has suffered from financial losses and doesn't have enough money to continue. The newspaper lost $16 million last year and has been unable to find a buyer. Several of its journalists have been rehired by its competitor, the Denver Post. The Rocky Mountain News is just the latest casualty in what some analysts are calling the death of print media. 33 daily newspapers have sought Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in the past 2.5 months. They blame a number of factors, including the poor economy, the decline in paid subscribers, and the loss of advertisers and competition from the Internet.
On Wednesday, an international court modeled after the Nuremberg Tribunal convicted three rebel leaders from Sierra Leone of crimes against humanity. The three leaders were known for asking their victims if they preferred long sleeves or short sleeves, and then cutting off the hands of those who chose the first option and the full arm that those that picked the second. The rebel leaders were found guilty on 16 of 18 counts, including mutilation, terrorism, rape, forced marriage, sexual slavery, and the enlistment of child soldiers. Sierra Leone was engaged in a brutal war over resources for over 10 years. It is one of the world's main sources of diamonds, and groups vying for control of the diamond fields have engaged in horrific and brutal tactics. Wednesday's trial marked the first time a perpetrator was found guilty of forced marriage, in which countless women suffered when they were forced to marry a rebel. Another first was the conviction of all three for attacking UN peacekeepers in 2000. In all, the special court has convicted 8 rebels and government leaders, just a fraction of those who took part in the violence.
A meeting next week in Egypt to deal with the crisis in Gaza will include not only Palestinian, Israeli, U.S., and Egyptian officials, but a representative from the Syrian government as well. The Syrian foreign minister told the media on Thursday that Syria would never be absent from a meeting on the reconstruction of Gaza. Syria's decision to participate comes at a time of increased tensions between Syria and Israel, given the shift to the right in the Israeli government that took place in the recent election. In addition, officials on both sides leaked statements to the media prior to Israel's invasion of Gaza that the two states were closer to an agreement than they had been in many years. But Israel's assault on Gaza beginning December 28th put an end to those negotiations. When the Israeli invasion began, Syria froze all ties with the Jewish state. Now, the Syrian foreign minister plans, for the first time since the Israeli invasion began, to sit at a negotiating table with Israeli officials. Although U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will be attending the talks, the There is no word yet as to whether she plans to meet with the Syrian foreign minister.
And now we have the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, February 26, 2009. Palestinian man dies in Gaza due to the Israeli siege, and a boy is killed by an Israeli explosive device in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian patient died on Thursday at Gaza hospital after the Israeli army barred him from leaving the Gaza Strip for medical treatment abroad, Palestinian medical sources in the Gaza Strip reported. The patient was identified as Hussam Hellis, 30, from Al-Shuja'iyah neighborhood east of Gaza City. He suffered from a heart disease which the Israeli siege left Gaza hospitals unable to treat, as most of their equipment is out of service and their medicine stores are out of basic supplies. Hellas had all necessary papers and transfer documents, but Israel still barred his transfer. The Ministry of Health in Gaza said that with the death of Hellas, the number of patients, including children and elderly, who have died due to the Israeli siege has reached 291. The ministry added that Hellas is the 19th patient who dies this month due to the siege. In other news, a Palestinian resistance group calling itself Hezbollah Gaza announced that it fired two homemade shells at Israeli targets. Israeli sources said that these landed in the Negev area, causing damage but no injuries. Elsewhere, a Palestinian boy from Tubas city in the northern part of the West Bank was killed on Thursday afternoon after an explosive device left by the Israeli army exploded next to him. Doctors reported that Jamal al-Fakha, 16, sustained injuries to his chest and abdomen. A metal object hit his heart, killing him. Meanwhile, medics said that other three young teenagers sustained moderate wounds due to the explosion. The Israeli army issued no statement regarding the incident. Also in the northern part of the West Bank, four Palestinian civilians were reported to have been kidnapped by the Israeli troops during pre-dawn invasions targeting the city of Jenin and nearby village of Ya'bad. Witnesses said that Israeli troops stormed Jenin, searched homes downtown, then kidnapped one civilian. Earlier on Wednesday night, local sources said that Israeli forces kidnapped three youths from the village of Ya'bad near Jenin whilst they were trying to plant an explosive device on the nearby settlers' road, military sources said. The families of the three boys told the media that the three were on their way back home and did not have any explosives with them. Thank you for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Ghassan Bannoura and George Ishmawi.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is William Sell, David Nockumson, and Maggie Starr. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Sun Lee.
And I'm Maggie Starr. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Marian Barasinek guest hosts on Positively Revolting Talk Radio. The topic is local responses to the housing crisis. At 9 on One Land, Many Voices, host Hala Goris speaks with attorney Tom Nelson, who just returned from Gaza as a member of the National Lawyers Guild delegation, to assess the effects of the recent attacks on the Palestinian people, and with Bill Corcoran, president of American Near East Refugee Aid. At 10, host Per Fagering speaks with Jeff Albert, one of the founders of the Akoya Institute, about freshwater scarcity and its effects on the struggle for Arab-Israeli peace. Albert is a water resource specialist. At 10:30, Pat McGuire hosts Boneheads and Bigots. At 11, it's Air Cascadia with Liam Delta and Chris Andre. And at 11:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, February 26, 2009. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, sitting in for Auda Fogato. President Obama releases his budget plan. He promises to cut the federal deficit and prioritize spending on health care, education, and energy. Meanwhile, lawmakers wrangle over a bill that would let homeowners fend off foreclosure by restructuring their loans through bankruptcy court. And Palestinian factions meet in Cairo to discuss forming a unity government. With the U.S. and Israel refusing to deal with Hamas, it may be their best chance to secure funds to rebuild the Gaza Strip. Those stories and more, but first, the headlines.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with today's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates announced today that the ban of media photographing coffins of returning U.S. soldiers will be lifted. Gates said the new policy will still allow families to opt out of having their loved ones' coffins photographed.
The decision regarding media coverage of the dignified transfer process at Dover should be made by those most directly affected, on an individual basis by the families of the fallen. We ought not presume to make that decision in their place.
President George H.W. Bush instituted the policy in 1991 in what many said was an attempt to keep Americans from understanding how many U.S. soldiers were being killed in wars overseas. A review of the policy was ordered by President Obama earlier this month. A UN war crimes tribunal has sentenced five former Serbian government and military officials to prison for crimes committed during the Kosovo conflict in the 1990s. But former Serbian president Milan Milutinovic was found not guilty. The tribunal found that the five helped forcibly deport ethnic Albanians in an effort to maintain Serbian control of Kosovo. Olga Karvan is a spokesperson for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia.
It is apparent that the trial chamber concluded that there was a broad campaign of violence conducted by forces under the control of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia and the Serbian authorities directed against the Kosovo Albanian civilian population during the course of the NATO airstrikes, and that the NATO bombing was not the reason for the mass displacement of Kosovo Albanians from Kosovo.
Sentences for the high-ranking officials range from 15 to 22 years. The trial is the first to be concluded regarding Serbian atrocities during the conflict in Kosovo. Revolting border guards in Bangladesh have surrendered to the government and retreated to their barracks, ending a 33-hour rebellion over low pay that killed at least 11 people. Bangladeshi authorities say all hostages have been freed and they are in full control of the situation, but the conflict has already taken a toll on the country's trade with neighboring India. Bismillah Gilani reports.
Economic activities on the Indo-Bangladesh international border came to a standstill as the mutiny by Bangladesh soldiers entered its second day this morning. As a result of soldiers and other posts briefly joining the rebellion, angry about pay and working conditions, the border remains virtually sealed and cross-border movement completely suspended. Hundreds of trucks, many of them loaded with perishable items, are stranded on the Indian side, waiting for permission to cross over. At least 8 border guards died in the revolt. Sheikh Hasina announced a general amnesty for the guards and assured that their demands will be looked into. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
The British Defense Secretary has admitted that his country aided the United States in its policy of rendition, or transferring suspects to foreign countries, often in order to skirt the laws regarding interrogation. Despite previous denials, Defense Secretary John Hutton said officials have long known that two Pakistani nationals were handed over to the U.S. in 2004. The two men, accused members of a group linked to Al-Qaeda, are still in U.S. custody in Afghanistan. The number of U.S. workers claiming unemployment benefits reached a new record in the second week of February, according to new figures released today by the Labor Department. More than 660,000 new claims were filed in the week ending February 21st. That's the most in a week since 1982. More than 5.1 million Americans are currently collecting unemployment, the most since 1967. The U.S. Justice Department is prosecuting a drug maker they claim paid doctors to prescribe its antidepressants, Celexa and Lexapro, and push the drugs for unapproved use on children. Rebecca Miles has more.
The federal complaint filed in civil court in Boston says the New York-based drug maker, Forest Labs, offered cash payments, expensive meals, and entertainment to induce doctors and others to prescribe the drugs. It also says the company illegally promoted Celexa for pediatric use, even though the FDA had denied permission to do so. Studies had showed Celexa, which is a serotonin inhibitor, posed several risks to children, including suicidal thoughts. Vera Chavraz from the Alliance for Human Research Protection says what the pharma companies are doing is dumping.
This is the modus operandi of the pharmaceutical industry. They want to expand the use of their drugs that run out of patent, and before they run out of patent, they're looking to expand the market beyond adults, and they're going for children. And these drugs pose very serious hazards for children.
The lawsuit comes following a five-year-long investigation, which began when two former employees whistleblew on the company's practices. 11 other states and the District of Columbia are expected to join the suit, alleging Forrest's actions triggered thousands of fraudulent claims to health care plans like Medicaid. Forest Labs says it's reviewing the complaint. A call placed to the company was not returned in time for our broadcast. Total sales for the drugs were $2.8 billion in 2008. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting from New York.
And today, February 26, marks 37 years since the Buffalo Creek disaster. A coal slurry dam in West Virginia broke, sending a 30-foot-high wall of water and coal waste rushing through several coal mining towns, killing 125 people, injuring 1,000, and leaving 4,000 people homeless. Many in Appalachia are frustrated at what they say is a refusal by government and industry to learn from Buffalo Creek. On Wednesday, three protesters were arrested after climbing Shumate Dam, which holds back almost 3 billion gallons of toxic coal waste in a sludge pond in southern West Virginia. Mike Roselle was one of those arrested.
We have been opposed to the mining above this dam because the fill is put behind the dam, the sludge is put behind the dam, and the liquids are put behind the dam. And they're blasting above it. And there's also people who live on the other sides of those ridges who are having rocks rolled down their roads and coming quite close to their property.
Roselle and two others are facing criminal trespass charges. It's the third time he's been arrested for civil disobedience in the last few weeks as part of growing local resistance to blasting and scraping of mountains and the dangerous dams that come along with mountaintop removal. And those are today's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
President Barack Obama has released a budget plan for the next 10 years. It outlines his priorities: healthcare, education, and energy. Democrats are praising the $3.5 trillion budget, but Republicans are calling it an economic disaster. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
In his address to Congress Tuesday, President Obama previewed his budget priorities.
I see it as a vision for America, as a blueprint for our future. My budget does not attempt to solve every problem or address every issue. It reflects the stark reality of what we've inherited, a trillion-dollar deficit, a financial crisis, and a costly recession.
His vision? to focus on healthcare, education, and energy. It creates a $630 billion health fund. It's considered a down payment for healthcare reform, the details of which are to be determined. Obama did outline his goals, which include universal coverage as well as plans that follow the employee from job to job. It increases higher education assistance through larger Pell Grants and through an education fund. It also commits money to renewable energy production and a cap-and-trade program to reduce carbon emissions. Jeremy Simons with the National Wildlife Foundation explains how the trading component would work after a scientific cap on carbon emissions is set.
Companies that lead in innovation and can reduce pollution with clean technologies and concepts will profit. Companies that have a harder time reducing pollution can lighten their load by paying other companies to make even deeper pollution reductions. In short, the cap-and-trade plan favors the marketplace instead of heavy-handed regulations.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi offers her praise for this budget.
At long last, a budget that is a statement of our national values, as the federal budget should be.
The budget includes the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the cost of the alternative minimum tax, and it takes into account disaster relief, all things that President Bush left out of his budgets. Republicans were quick to criticize this proposal, saying it's dangerous in this economy. House Republican Leader John Boehner.
The era of big government is back, and Democrats are asking you to pay for it. The administration's plan, I think, is a job killer, plain and simple.
It raises taxes on families making $250,000 per year. It also makes permanent some tax cuts for middle-class families, such as the $800 tax cut just passed in the stimulus. Mark Goldwine is an economist with the New America Foundation.
People making over $250,000 are really bearing almost the entire brunt of this, and it's insufficient to pay for what he's proposing. If there's not some major cut in spending over time, he can't get this deficit under control.
President Obama touts that his budget reduces the deficit in half, from $1 trillion to $500 billion by the end of his first term. But Democrats and Republicans agree that the long-term debt is still too great. North Dakota Democrat Kent Conrad, chair of the Budget Committee.
We've got to do more about the debt buildup that will occur over the following years. And so I think that becomes one of our significant ongoing challenges.
President Bush came into office with a $5 trillion long-term debt. He more than doubled it, passing a $12 trillion debt to President Obama. This budget is just a blueprint. Additional details will come in April. At that time, Congress will begin working to finalize it. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As that foreclosure bill makes its way through Congress, the Obama administration is still wrestling with how to handle looming failures at some of the world's largest financial institutions. As of airtime, the federal government was reportedly finishing a deal with Citigroup, Inc. that could be announced as early as this afternoon. The deal is reported to center around converting the money the government has already used to bail out the corporation into common stock, which would give the U.S. government control over roughly 40% of the company's voting equity. Joining me to discuss the impending Citigroup deal is Lawrence Mitchell, professor of business law at George Washington University and author of The Speculation Economy: How Finance Triumphed Over Industry. So let's start with the Citigroup deal. What do you think of making the government a stakeholder, albeit a minority stakeholder, in one of the world's largest banks?
Well, I would change the word stakeholder to stockholder. And that's kind of important because as residual claimant, common stockholders are the highest risk category of investment in the financial structure of a corporation, which effectively means that an awful lot of federal wealth will depend upon the success of this investment. Now, you mentioned it as a minority investment, and that's true. My initial reaction to that was negative. It was, if we're going to be putting this kind of money in, why aren't we taking control? And then on further reflection, I realized that there's a good reason not to take control. First, the 40%, and I don't know the stockholding structure of Citigroup, but I assume that no other single stockholder comes close to owning 40%, would effectively give the federal government control, not such that it could absolutely and by itself determine the board of directors, but would be a sufficient block that the likelihood is that whoever the government stockholder, or let's just call it us, wants to see on the board would succeed in being on the board and would give us tremendous influence over that board. The good reason not to do it is that a majority stockholder owes a fiduciary duty to minority stockholders. That is to say, owes a duty in whatever it does as a stockholder to be fair to minority stockholders. And that means equal distributions of everything, not taking any actions that could prejudice the minority stockholders in favor of the majority stockholder. As a 40% stockholder with effective control to do that anyway, we don't have the fiduciary obligation, which means that although it may not be good public policy, the federal government could fairly likely run roughshod over the minority shareholders and they'd have no actionable claim.
They seem to be dancing around actually calling something like this nationalization. The New York Post today is quoting sources inside the administration saying they will not oust Vikram Pandit. That's the CEO of Citigroup Incorporated. Do you think we're ever going to see this administration using that word for what they're doing?
No. I think it's hilarious that they don't. I mean, I don't know what we're talking about if not nationalization. And that's not a bad word. I mean, we've nationalized industries before when we've had to. We nationalized the railroads during World War I. We nationalized the steel industry or attempted to in World War II, after World War II. In this case, the nationalization seems to me to be necessary to stabilize the system. You have a bunch of independent financial actors running around. Their only coordination point is their own best interests. And by the federal government effectively taking them over, there's at least a unified coordination to get things stable. Whether you call it nationalization or not doesn't matter, except perhaps to hysterical Republicans who view that as the imminent dawn of the Socialist Republic of the United States.
It does raise the question of what nationalization means in the age of transnational capital. Citigroup is a company that owns banks all over the world. Many of the countries that it operates in have restrictions on companies owned by foreign governments operating their local banks, and the biggest one is Banamex in Mexico.
Right.
Is there a legitimate concern that this could break off some of the more profitable parts of Citigroup?
Well, there's a question. Yes, there is, but the question of breaking up parts of Citigroup may very well also go to an underlying policy question of how big we want these institutions to be. One of the things that we have found happened since at least the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999 is banks that are just absolutely disproportionately enormous, which gives them tremendous power over the American and then indirectly the global or directly the global credit system. And what may be behind some of this or lack of concern with some of this is a desire to decrease the size of financial institutions.
Well, Lawrence Mitchell, I want to thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Lawrence Mitchell is professor of business law at George Washington University. He's also author of The Speculation Economy, How Finance Triumphed Over Industry. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill wrangled over the Helping Families Save Their Homes Act today. The bill would allow homeowners to restructure their loans through bankruptcy, potentially forcing lenders to reduce both the interest and the amount owed. Karen Miller has more.
Under current law, bankruptcy judges can restructure debt on assets such as a second home, family farms, and boats, but not a first home. But that could change under the Helping Families Save Their Homes Act. The proposal would allow homeowners who are filing for bankruptcy the chance to restructure their loans so that they can save their homes from foreclosure. This bill would give bankruptcy judges the ability to change mortgage terms on these homes in an effort to help people stay in their homes. Representative Kathy Castor from Florida says people are looking for relief.
I rise today in strong support of the Helping Families Save Their Homes Act and this rule. This act throws a lifeline to families who are fighting to stay in their homes during this economic crisis.
Back in October, the Bush administration had set up the Hope for Homeowners program that allowed lenders to voluntarily modify mortgages. But critics say the Hope program has fallen short and misses a target audience. So far, many lenders are not volunteering. Under that program, homeowners would restructure through what's called workout plans. Center for Responsible Lending spokesperson Kathleen Day explains.
Workout plans are for people who can afford their mortgage, except for they've had a one-time economic setback, like a divorce, an illness, or a job loss. they need temporary help getting back, bringing whatever they're in arrears on up to date. That does not work for a loan, the kinds of loans that have torpedoed the economy. The loans at the heart of this economic crisis were loans that were made that are fundamentally unaffordable for people.
The Bush administration had estimated that hundreds of thousands of people would be helped by the Hope for Homeowners program. But by the end of 2008, the program had only received several hundred applications. Proponents of the Helping Families Save Their Homes Act hope this time the plan will save more people from entering foreclosure. But the banking industry opposes the bill. On Thursday, the American Banking Association, along with other lenders, sent a letter to Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi in opposition to the bill. The letter states that allowing bankruptcy judges to rewrite terms of a mortgage would add even more instability to the market. Republicans speaking on the House floor Thursday agreed and offered a familiar criticism. Some say allowing homeowners who file bankruptcy the opportunity to save their home is rewarding those who are irresponsible. North Carolina Representative Virginia Fox.
People who loan other people money want them to pay it back dollar for dollar. That's the way most of us operate in this country. However, most of these people who got these loans that are in trouble now got them because they never expected to pay them back. People who irresponsibly got mortgages to begin with continue to look for bailouts and continue to look for welfare. This is basically expanding the welfare program in our country by passing this bill.
Currently, banks can make more money on a foreclosure than a restructure. President Obama's recent home mortgage plan will now give lenders a financial incentive to restructure a loan. Congress is continuing to review the bill and is expected to vote on the bill next week. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
In the Sri Lankan capital of Colombo, police have confirmed they arrested a Tamil newspaper editor whose relatives had reported him as abducted. The arrest comes as the government faces criticism for a spate of attacks on journalists critical of the ongoing military operations against Tamil Tiger rebels. Panaya Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
The editor of reputed Sudarulian Udayan newspapers was allegedly taken by force by civil and uniformed police. Nadesapulle Vidyadharan was attending a funeral when witnesses say six men drew up in a van and pulled him from a crowd of mourners and then drew away. Sunanda Deshapriya is a former editor and a prominent media activist.
Vidyadharan has met LCD leaders on behalf of the government sometimes. Other than the editor, he has played the role of peacemaker or messenger between this government and the Tamil militant movement also to some extent. In that sense, I think he's a very important person.
Vidyadharan's newspapers have been staunchly critical of the military campaign against the LTTE, who are cornered in the northeastern part of the island. The police says he has been taken in for questioning regarding two articles that appeared recently in one of those newspapers. But media activists say that normal procedures were not followed in his arrest. His arrest has come 7 weeks after another prominent editor was killed. Lasantha Vikramathunga worked for the Sunday Leader. He was gunned down in the same area by unidentified attackers. Eswarapadam Saravanabhavan is the managing director of Udayan Publications, which publishes the two newspapers for which Vidyadharan is the chief editor.
On the Press Freedom Day, May 3rd, 2006, gunmen got into our premises and they shot at people. Two died there and four people got injured. They ransacked the whole place. They destroyed the entire paper system. They burnt our stores and they threw hand grenades. So many things have taken place. In spite of that, the staff and the editorial, they are very brave. They are continuing in the democratic manner. They don't hold arms or anything.
Reporters Without Borders has demanded the immediate release of the editor. According to official figures, 9 journalists have been killed in the past 3 years, 27 have been attacked, and 4 people are currently detained. Many have fled the country. The government has promised investigations, but media organizations, and journalists say no one has been brought to justice. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vaunia, Sri Lanka.
A dozen Palestinian factions met today in Cairo to discuss the formation of a unity government after nearly 18 months of sometimes violent conflict between Fatah and Hamas. The summit's organizers say Palestinians will need a unified government to oversee reconstruction of the Gaza Strip in the wake of Israel's bombardment and invasion. They also say that without a unified government, it will be very difficult to eventually secure a Palestinian state through negotiations. Aya Batraoui has more from Cairo.
After talks in Cairo began, representatives of Hamas and Fatah agreed to halt hostile media campaigns and release a number of detainees held by the two sides. A Hamas senior official and leader of the Fatah parliamentary bloc, Azam Al-Ahmad, spoke at a joint press conference following their meeting on Wednesday in Cairo. Al-Ahmad explained the committees they're forming and the issues they're trying to tackle.
There will be government elections and security committees, as well as a committee to deal with the occupation, and one for internal disputes.
One area both Fatah and Hamas agree on is that Gaza will need over $1 billion to rebuild after the Israeli offensive. But Hamas, the party that's in power in the Gaza Strip, has been deemed a terrorist organization by the United States and other Western powers. So any international aid money coming in for reconstruction cannot legally go under the control of the Gaza Strip's governing bodies. Meanwhile, amid the political dispute over who gets the international aid money, thousands of Gazans line up for handouts of blankets, sugar, flour, and other basic goods to survive. Those who lost their homes are at best either living in temporary tents set up by the UN or received a bit of money from Hamas to live temporarily in rented apartments, all while waiting for the various Palestinian factions to move beyond the politics and form a unity government as soon as possible. Recently, FSRN spoke to the Gaza Strip's Minister of Housing, Dr. Yusuf Al-Mansi. Dr. Mansi is responsible for solving the problem of the nearly 100,000 people displaced from the Israeli war. His deputy minister, translating for him, said they would not accept any international aid coming in from the West Bank, where Hamas's rival Fatah is in power, because there are concerns the money won't be allocated properly.
First of all, their history is not clean, and you have many corruption reports from the international organizations about the corruption and the money which disappeared. And the second thing, those people who cut our salaries due to political reasons, they are not liable to deal with our problems. I think that they will channel everything to their own benefit. They are not honest enough.
Gaza, which has one of the highest unemployment rates in the world and is home to around 1 million refugees, depends heavily on international aid. But immediately after the Islamist Hamas party won elections, aid was cut. Tensions grew between Fatah supporters and its rival Hamas in Gaza, leading to a bloody civil war in the summer of 2007 that resulted in a complete takeover of the Strip by Hamas. One of the biggest differences between the two parties is that Hamas believes it has the right to defend itself against Israel, while Fatah has relied on diplomatic talks. According to Egyptian analyst Dr. Gamal Sultan of the Al Ahram Center, Palestinian unity is important for peace in the region. It's also in Egypt's interest to have a unity government rather than have Gaza ruled solely by Hamas, which is an offshoot of Egypt's politically banned Muslim Brotherhood, whose members are often arrested. But Dr. Sultan said that the current Palestinian crisis is not just a result of infighting, but due to years of failed peace talks.
So we shouldn't just being obsessed by putting the blame on Hamas, on the radicals in the Middle East. We have also to blame all parties, Israel and the United States in particular, who had a number of opportunities to end this conflict by reaching peace agreements between the Palestinians and the Israelis during the last 15 years since the peace process began. This is a major failure against which the current episode of conflict in the Middle East is taking place.
Egypt will be hosting a donors conference for Gaza early next month that will be attended by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other officials from over 80 nations. The hope is that the unity talks being held in Cairo this week will pave the way for aid being distributed quickly and efficiently. Reporting for FSRN from Cairo, this is Aya Batraoui.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Check us out online at www.fsrn.org. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Catherine Kopp and Vino K. Joes produced today's broadcast. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our headlines editors are Jess Burns and Nell Abrams. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Puck Lowe and Rose Katapchi. For archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, go to our website, www.fsrn.org. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, sitting in for Aura Bogado.
Friday, March 6th, Headlock Music, Rough Cuts Clothing, and KBOO Community Radio welcome the fireman Anthony B. to Portland, live and direct, straight out of Jamaica, for a night of conscious roots and dancehall reggae. Doors at 8, show starts at 9, with Don Dignitaries, J. Ross Pirelli, and the Escort Service Band. Small Axe Sound with YT and MC Jaga are in the house as well. All this at Barbati's downtown at Southwest 3rd and Antony. A portion of the proceeds of this 21 and over event will benefit KBOO Community Radio. Yes, Anthony B.
Tune in Tuesdays for a full hour of arts coverage from Portland and around the Northwest, with D. May Roberts on stage and studio on Tuesday starting 11 a.m., followed by Arts Focus with Ava Lake at 11:30 a.m. Get your arts news and find out what's going on in your community with a full hour of arts and culture Tuesdays from 11 a.m. to 12 noon here on KBOO 90.7 FM or online at kboo.fm.
The time is 6 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany. You can also listen to us at kboo.fm on the web, of course. Coming up next is We the People.
Welcome to We the People, where civil liberties comes first. I'm your host, Alejandro Caral.
And I'm Joanne Zuhl.
And I'm Linda Olsen-Osterlund.
In today's show, we will be interviewing Chuck Sedetik, author of Madam Prosecutor, Confronting Jimenez's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity, and Professor Francis Boyle, University of Illinois law professor, international recognized expert in international law and human rights. We want to invite your calls at 503-231-8187 and contribute to the show. Some of the questions that we'll be exploring during this hour is whether the Bush administration should be held accountable for possible war crimes, or what are the obligations of the Obama administration to restore the rule of law. What would be the legal and political consequences of such prosecutions and investigations? So please join us, 503-231-8187, or send us an email at wtpkboo@gmail.com.
Chuck Sedetik is the co-author of the controversial book, Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. This book is the memoir of his co-author, Carla Del Ponte. She was the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunals over both Yugoslavia and Rwanda. The book is a prosecutor's look at the first war crimes trial since World War II. Sedetik is an award-winning journalist. He covered the wars in the Balkans for the New York Times, and he for a time served as a consultant to the tribunals. What follows is an interview I did with him earlier this week. Thanks for joining us here at KBOO.
It's nice to be here, Linda.
Can you sort of set the scene of when was the beginning of these war crimes, and what were the biggest incidents that needed to be looked into, and what did it take to investigate these?
Well, the first thing you have to realize is that the United Nations Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia was created by the UN Security Council at a time when there was a major offensive going on against a place called Srebrenica that the members of the Security Council did not want to vote to intervene to stop. So it was kind of a fallback position to create deterrence going forward against war crimes. Unfortunately, deterrence wasn't sufficient to stop another massacre occurring 2 years later in the same place, Srebrenica. What Madame Del Ponte was involved in as the prosecutor, what her job was to liaise with the governments of the countries that came into being after the breakup of Yugoslavia, those being Serbia, Bosnia, and Croatia, and to extract from them cooperation for prosecution of persons suspected of war crimes, evidence, the arrest of people who were indicted, and protection of witnesses. The only legal authority that she had was, her legal authority was very limited. She had less legal authority to impose her will upon those countries than, for example, a criminal court in Portland that's trying the drug dealer from down the street. She couldn't issue subpoenas and have them enforced. She couldn't issue indictments and have them enforced. And she couldn't demand or ensure protection of witnesses. What she had to do was rely upon voluntary assistance.
She also relied a lot upon her own will, her own determination. During the time that she was on these tribunals, really it was her strength of personality, though I sometimes think that may have been offensive to people. When she writes about herself, you can tell she's a bull. She doesn't back down, and she goes straight to the point and is often very direct and confrontive. But she clearly sees that as her main role, that it took her belief in her right to bring these charges and to have the fugitives be brought to justice.
That's precisely correct. And the results showed. I mean, dozens of people who were indicted were brought to the tribunals in Yugoslavia and the Rwanda tribunal as well, through the assertion of her will. People who have criticized Madame Del Ponte over the years have essentially been diplomats who are involved in a much different game. Madame Del Ponte comes into this as a prosecutor. She's collecting evidence. She's drawing up indictments. Those indictments have to be approved by a judge from the tribunal before they can be served. And once they are, she did not stop to lower her guard and make, for example, unwarranted compromises at any time. And it proved to be effective. There's been a softer approach taken. And mind you, at the end of her mandate, after 8 years in the Yugoslavia tribunal, she had only four individuals who were left at large. One of them was pretty much immaterial. He can be tried at home. The other three, Goran Hadžić, Ratko Mladić, and Radovan Karadžić, are pretty high-ranking people. And Karadžić was brought into custody not long afterwards. Just to say that they've tried a softer approach since Del Ponte left, and it's not been effective in bringing in the other three.
Joe, so can you talk a little bit about Mladic, the man who did get away?
In mid-July 1995, approximately 7,000 to 8,000 Bosnian Muslims were taken captive by the Bosnian Serb army under the command of Ratko Mladic. On the morning of July 12th, thereabouts, Mladic said that the people who were taken prisoner were going to be killed. This was evidence that's been adduced in trials at the tribunal beforehand. It's the evidence is there for anybody to read. All they have to do is look at it. And you had the summary executions of thousands and thousands of young men taken prisoners, had their arms bound, and were summarily shot. Subsequent to that, there was a great denial going on, and then, you know, sure enough, they found the mass graves. And for years and years and years, Ratko Mladic enjoyed the protection of both the Serbian government and, as he still does today, the military or elements of the military of Serbia. And he's protected there in a way that's it's frustrated the efforts of people like Madame Del Ponte for her 8 years, but he was indicted originally in 1996, so the man has been at large for 13 years.
And this kind of massacre that took place there, it even shocked the people of Serbia. It took, I believe, a video of some of the troops who were called scorpions that were bringing the men to execution. That video aired late in Ms. Del Ponte's reign as chief prosecutor, but was finally got into the public's eye, and they were able to see that indeed their leaders had done these things that they were accused of.
Yes, exactly. It took graphic evidence, a video that the shooters, that the executioners had taken of themselves shooting the prisoners. Imagine how brazen that is. These were teenagers. And then showing that to your friends on video. That's what got out. And finally, when it was brought into the public domain, all of a sudden the denial could no longer be maintained. And action had to be taken to quote unquote clean up their act, in terms of saying, oh yes, well, this, you know, this did happen. There were some mea culpas given, and there was a little bit more cooperation in terms of the arrest of some lower ranking people who were involved in giving orders. Mind you, that Del Ponte's job was not to arrest the guys who did the shooting on the ground. Her job was to go after the high ranking guys, the ones who gave the orders, the high-ranking managers of this thing. But even with that revelation, it still wasn't enough and hasn't been enough to bring General Mladic to justice. And this is not persecution. He's going to stand trial and face facts and face his accusers, and people are going to step forward and give testimony against him, and it's going to be up to judges to decide whether he's guilty or innocent. But if you don't put him on trial, you're leaving yourself open to either allowing impunity to continue, which will only mean more Holocausts, more Cambodias, more Rwandas, more Bosnias, or you're going to allow for vengeance to rear its ugly head.
I'm speaking with Chuck Sudetic, co-author of Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. And you just mentioned impunity again, Mr. Sudetic, and I noticed that the main thing that Madam Prosecutor Carla Del Ponte was able to rely on was the pressure brought by larger countries, countries with very real power, economic power, the United States in particular, and also the European Union as a group. And that when she pressured them to put economic pressure on Serbia and the other nations involved, she was criticized by Kofi Annan, then the head of the United Nations. She later points out that it was, in fact, that very pressure that was successful. I think there came a point when Serbia very much wanted to take part in a certain meeting that was a donors meeting where there was going to be the hope for economic aid. And it was at the very last minute that they began to arrest and turn over a large number of those indicted that the criminal court had been seeking for a long time.
Reading Madam Prosecutor, what you see is, first and foremost, that the guy, it's clear from the text, who deserves the lion's share of credit for applying the really early pressure to get Milosevic arrested and handed over, which really opened the floodgates for the arrest of further people from Serbia, was Secretary of State Colin Powell. He stood up when, in the first few months of the Bush administration, when Del Ponte wasn't at all sure how the U.S. would come down on a war crimes tribunal, which way would the Bush administration swing. And now, mind you, the Bush administration's positions on war crimes tribunals isn't exactly the most friendly. But Powell stood four square beside her and said, no, we have the discretion to certify whether there's cooperation with the tribunal before we allow there to be the release of financial assistance to Serbia. And it was largely through that leverage that they were able to produce the arrest and the handover of Milosevic. And as I said, that opened the gate for a lot of other arrests and handovers.
Can you talk a little bit about the Rwanda tribunals and the parallels to the Yugoslavian tribunal?
The parallels are very difficult, but I can talk about what Del Ponte attempted to do in wielding her authority to investigate and present indictments. What her job was to go after the highest ranking people responsible for war crimes on all sides of the given conflict. Now, in Rwanda, primarily, you had 800,000 people massacred within weeks, and primarily her job was to go after the leadership of the Hutu who had carried this out, who had given the orders, who had whipped up their people into a frenzy to go out and machete their neighbors. That said, however, the tit-for-tat violence that had been going on and ratcheting up in Rwanda over the period preceding the genocide was unmistakable. And one of the things that a war crimes tribunal must do in order to establish any credibility at all is, as I said, to try individuals on all sides. Del Ponte wanted to investigate very credible reports of the killings of many thousands of Hutus by Tutsis that went on both during that genocide and afterwards. And what happened when she attempted to do that was basically what I describe in the book as the Muro de Goma. The Kagame people didn't want to have anything to do with it. They were opposed. They blocked. They tapped the phones of the tribunal. They did everything to thwart the investigation. And then finally, when it was announced that Del Ponte wanted to have just one case, and that was the case of the murders of about 10 Catholic clerics, including a few bishops, who had been taken prisoner and held for a few days and then killed. So there wasn't like an immediate killing that could have been done in a rage of passion. When she wanted to investigate that, the entire effort was blocked by the government of Rwanda, and then efforts were undertaken by Rwanda and with some support from the U.S. and Great Britain to remove Del Ponte as the prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And since then, there has been no more talk about presenting indictments against Tutsis.
What were the reasons that she was not able to bring that support from the United States and the EU to back her up in Rwanda?
Because people were so concerned of it got into the problem of diplomacy and how you want to proceed in that part of Africa, which is a tinderbox. Remember, Linda, since 1994, there's been a war going on there just off Rwanda's border that has caused more deaths than any other conflict since World War II.
We're talking
numbers
about the
Congo. Numbers in the millions, and it's in eastern Congo. Largely started as a spin-off from the Rwanda genocide. So people looking to create stability in that part of the country and trying to nail that stability to the regime of Kagame in Rwanda don't want to see him shaken up by any war crimes indictments, and so they had that interest in seeing that it wasn't undertaken.
You have been listening to part one of Linda Olson's interview with Chuck Sedetic, who is a co-author along with Carlo Del Ponte, FMATA prosecutor confronting him in his worst criminals and the culture of impunity. Joanne Zoll and Linda Olson are joining us in the studio, and we want to invite you to give us a call at 503-231-8187 and tell us what you think, pose some questions to our panel. And also, if you want to send your comments via email, you can do so at wtpkboo@gmail.com. Linda, your interview with Chuck Sedetic revealed, I think, one thing that it hasn't been very clear to those of us that don't follow international law very closely, and that is that some of the weaknesses inherent in this systems of justice are that it requires the cooperation of the countries that are hosting these war criminals.
Yes, exactly, and that is sort of the conundrum, isn't it? And I think it and probably some of these would never move forward if they weren't targeting, if they were targeting some other people. And I think that we saw that in Rwanda. As soon as she wanted to target the other side of the conflict that had also committed genocide, she was pulled from that. There were other reasons given for pulling her, but I believe that that was at least a large part of it. And so what do you do in a world where the most powerful commit war crimes and they don't want to give them up? And I think that's going to be some of what we talk about as we go on is, obviously right now some of the countries committing war crimes are famous. There's Darfur. There's, Khmer Rouge recently been brought up, the Sudan. Also in the Congo and other countries like that. But I think for myself, the ones that I've been most uncomfortable with, of course, have been those committed by my own nation or with my tax dollars by Israel in Gaza. And so here we have war crimes going on, but who's going to try them? I think that's the question for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about what is part of what motivated this show was, what are these institutions that would deal with international justice so that, because one thing that I think we've seen happen or not happen is that there hasn't really been any prosecutions in the international level of any Americans who have been engaged in this kind of wrongdoing. Now, Joanne, some would say that the Bush administration's actions do not amount to the kind of war crimes that happened in Yugoslavia, where thousands of young men were summarily executed, in Rwanda, where it's clear actions of genocide. We'll listen to your interview later on the show, Professor Francis Boyle, but in your conversation with him, we should say that Francis Boyle is inviting I should let you describe what his position is.
His position is that the President of the United States, unequivocally, should be held on charges of murder. And he's looking at the murder of all of the U.S. soldiers that have died in Iraq on his grounds and of his supporters and his network. It is the argument definitely that it was an unjust war, it was an illegal war, and that every man and woman who died over there under that charge is that's blood on the president's hand, essentially. I think, when we talk to him, you'll hear his concerns for the efficacy of an international court and what it can really do in this case. But I thought it was interesting bringing up what you talked about with Chuck Sudetic, Linda, that he mentioned that one of the key factors to getting these prosecutions taken care of was the pressure brought to bear by larger countries, notably the United States. And we're talking about very small countries, very politically weak countries in many sense that are charged. But now, as you say, we are now reflecting it back on the most powerful country in the world, if you want to phrase it that way. So who's going to bring any, justice to bear on that, particularly if he's saying that the international courts are now getting softer with the absence of DePonte? So I think it's interesting what could happen in the next 5-10 years.
Well, and the tribunals that DePonte was head of were set up by the Security Council. Now, the Security Council often vetoes things. So we have how many General Assembly resolutions against Israel and yet no action because the United States protects Israel from the Security Council. And so clearly you do have those problems. There were also accusations of the United States participating in war crimes in its bombing, NATO bombing and U.S. bombing of Kosovo in the Balkan Wars in the end in 99. And Madame DePonte did look into those and wouldn't have minded trying to go into them. She could get no cooperation from any government on any side because who wants to go up against the U.S. to turn over documents, emails, individuals, to provide enforcement, someone to go arrest individuals if indictments can be brought? No one did. So she really was unable even to go forward into investigating those. So I think, there is a very serious problem, and it throws it back on the people of this country and the people of all around the world, because we're not, by any means, we don't, we're not the only ones committing war crimes, as we've seen.
But now, as I understand it, Linda, the United States would have to be a signatory. In other words, would have to agree with the international community that they would be bound by these rules and this rule of law at the international level. But the United States hasn't done that.
Actually, we did. We signed it, and then we unsigned it. An international criminal court was brought into existence starting with something called the Rome Statute, and it was an international movement to bring new criminal courts into being, and they came into being while these tribunals were going on separately. These were Security Council ones. So that International Criminal Court, we does rely on being signatories, and we deal with that more later with Sudetic, so we'll get into that later. But yes, the United States did originally sign that compact, and then under Bush, unsign that compact, something highly unusual.
And in my conversation with Professor Boyle, he puts his spin on that as well, whether or not we're talking about crimes that were committed within the boundaries of the United States or how much this is happening in other countries that do fall under the
guidelines.
What
I found interesting is most countries that were operating in militarily have unsigned as well or never signed. So the crimes are neither happening within a country of a signatory or to a country of a signatory, making it. But that's what we'll deal with a little bit later. We'll
considering
that.
Considering black sites, considering where torture and considering, you know, even to the minutiae of whether we flew over these countries, you know, I think it's all things to be extrapolated, and maybe it's, you know, maybe it's fantasy in some part, but it's something to consider. And if you're trying to build a case, you know, it all factors in. So
yeah, perhaps Poland is a signatory, and I believe we used a base there.
503-231-8187. We invite you to give us a call and tell us what you think. Our topic today is war crimes and impunity. One of the questions I think that has been raised implicitly is what is the effectiveness of this war crime tribunals or international criminal court? Because one thing, I mean, if we look at it from perspective of, you know, traditional jurisprudence, what, you know, the concept behind prosecuting and incarcerating people is to stop the action, prevent it from happening again, hold those accountable, but to some extent send a message of deterrence to potential perpetrators of other crimes. We continue to see genocide. We continue to see leaders taking, their own populations and either sending them to illegal wars or ordering their mass murder. Is this effective? Is this the way to go? I mean, how far have we advanced the ball towards justice?
Well, I think that's one of the big questions, isn't it? I think probably 8 years ago we would have had a different answer. I think that we're now, I would say before the Bush administration, we may have felt hopeful about the opportunities to, even though Clinton was involved in what many considered war crimes in the Balkans, I still think at that time we had more opportunity to have real deterrence take place from international criminal courts. I think we're in a new era. I think that question is open.
Joanne, do you think that the U.S. has lost face in this, and then that's what's sort of creating a detriment or an ability to...
I think that it is amazing. I agree with you that it is very discouraging for, you know, youth or, you know, lessons of the Holocaust and think, well, it'll never happen again, and yet you can tick off all the countries where it is happening. And you could look at this as... as some have argued that this is really another stage of the Third World War. You know, it's happening in poor countries, it's happening among poor people, and it's happening, you know, where generations are being slaughtered. So, you know, it's frustrating that there isn't that kind of cause and effect impact of these kind of prosecutions. But, they're perhaps, you know, in the history of all of things, perhaps a young state right now. I mean, these kind of international courts, this kind of prosecutions, these examples. So, I mean, I don't know. I think we have to be hopeful that perhaps something will change. It's discouraging, I'm sure, for Americans to be in this position and looking at what our record is at this point. But, I think the impact is, I think, still be seen.
The Balkans right now is still a tinderbox. Areas in Africa are still a tinderbox. And I think that, and maybe that's not quite the right thing to say about the Balkans, but we just saw the Kosovo Independence National Day, and that was kind of whipped up in that country and got media. And then, of course, you know, Serbia responded, there is no Kosovo. And so you have those same kind of tensions. And I do think that it's possible that the tribunal in Yugoslavia could serve as a deterrent there, in the sense that even though Mladic is still out, he's the last one hanging out there, that many of the participants at the highest levels on these crimes did either die in prison, or like Milosevic, head of Serbia, and Tudjman of Croatia, before he could be brought to trial, nonetheless, they saw their future shorten for their activities in that. Now, that lesson could be, you're going to, you know, a tribunal and you'll end up in jail, or that lesson could be, if you get on the wrong side of the U.S., you'll end up in a tribunal and end up in jail.
Or perhaps the lesson that's coming out of it, as Chuck Sudetic was talking about, is that these systems are inherently weak. I mean, if you're talking about relying on the cooperation of the country itself to provide evidence to arrest the people and to bring them into court, you know, along with the pressure of major countries working with you. So, you know, I think the loopholes are far and wide, and I think that's where, you know, that's the problem. And I think we're going to have to see more of these cases before we actually see how we can have an international justice system.
I think some would say that part of what we need is to have the entire community of international actors be part of this and agree to this. But even then, there is a role that politics will play, as we saw in the example of Rwanda and the U.S. interfering with prosecution. Does that then undermine, basically, I mean, will politics always undermine this international war crime tribunals? Or diplomacy?
Yeah, can it ever be free of politics?
Could it ever be free of politics?
I doubt it could ever be free of politics. And I'm not certain whether we can get beyond a reality of might makes right. I believe we have a caller, though. Let's go ahead and bring that caller on. Welcome to KBOO. Go ahead. You're on.
I think we might have lost the caller, unfortunately. But we'll continue to have a discussion later on the show. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll go to part two of the Chuck Sudetic interview. So stay with us.
And it's in God we trust. So we'll bomb you during Ramadan. Turn your world into dust. But pull up on your bootstraps. Stand on your own two feet. As we blow them off with cluster bombs disguised as something to eat. We stand for freedom and prosperity. So we'll bomb your schools and hospitals. Make sure you live in liberty. And all you evildoers and your children and your wives. With our B-52s we'll show you how we value civilian lives. Give us your hungry, your restless. We'll show you democracy.
And now we'll go back to part two of the interview with Chuck Sudetic.
Carla DePonte talks about wanting to end impunity, end the sense that leaders, powerful leaders, can order the destruction of thousands of people's lives with impunity, with no retribution, that they can break the laws of the international community and have no justice served. And I am wondering about whether or not she actually struck a blow for impunity. I suppose she did. She did get some high-level leaders, and yet she had to rely on a government that now the international community knows carries out war crimes. It's nowhere mentioned in her book, though her book goes up to 2007. She must have been aware of the accusations of war crimes against the United States. Was that ever anything discussed about, whether that should be in the book or not?
And frankly, we had enough complications in dealing with presenting the material from Yugoslavia and Rwanda to engage in speculation about what America was doing and admittedly doing in other parts of the world, or what other people were doing. We didn't mention Congo in this as well, mm-hmm. and there's a whole lot worse case going on in Congo. We wanted to the value added that we saw here was there's a movement afoot to bring people who are suspected and accused of committing war crimes, say Darfur, say Charles Taylor in West Africa, Sierra Leone, Liberia, say the leaders in of the militia in the Congo, Cambodia. There's a movement afoot to bring these people to justice. The value added here is to get a very detailed look at the problems that these tribunals, these efforts face, and what they have faced here in this Rwanda example, where political maneuverings on the outside brought down the prosecutor, and in the Yugoslavia example, where you had it's a detailed inventory of things that local governments did, Croatia and Serbia, to thwart the tribunal's work and what had to be done to pry cooperation from these people. And this, I think, needed to be said to the people who are most interested in international justice proceeding and strengthening the force against allowing impunity to continue. Since Yugoslavia was the first out of the box. The Yugoslavia Tribunal was the first to begin after 40 years after the tribunals at Nuremberg and Tokyo. Those tribunals were essentially victor's justice. Yugoslavia had to rely on much weaker leverage, much weaker legal realities than Tokyo or Nuremberg. And seeing its experience can only be valuable going forward in engineering mechanisms that can, on an ongoing basis, as we see now with the creation of the International Criminal Court, and it's just in recent days, the issuance of the indictment against the leader of Sudan for Darfur, that it can use and draw on this experience to bring these people to trial and hopefully chip away little by little over the decades against this impunity that has gone on too long.
I hear what you're saying about that, and I do think that there you certainly learn what it takes to run an international tribunal. But when I look at the International Criminal Court now, one of the limitations that it has is that it can only prosecute those who are either signatories or who committed crimes in nations that are signatories. And countries like, say, Israel right now, that is alleged to have committed a number of war crimes in Gaza, and nations like the United States who have withdrawn their signatures from that international war crimes tribunal. So we're no longer a signatory to that. So, and I noticed that any of the countries we're operating in militarily are no longer signatories to that. Therefore, a strong attempt to put the most powerful nations outside the reach of international criminal courts. That presents a particular set of problems, doesn't it?
It sure does. But you know, Linda, I don't think you want to make the best the enemy of the good in this situation.
Say that again.
You don't want to make the best the enemy of the good. In other words, what I'm saying is you can't expect to engineer a perfect international criminal court that's going to gather when in a world where there are so many interests that are at loggerheads. There's no way to engineer something that complicated and that intrusive upon diplomacy, intelligence, military decision-making, these things, all at once. And, you know, the United States, President Clinton, and one of the last things that he did was to sign the ICC Rome Treaty. One of the first things that President Bush did was to erase the signature, which was an unprecedented thing as far as I understand. But, you know, time goes by, and things change. You know, it took a long time for the Genocide Pact treaty to be ratified. It took a long time for the landmines treaty to be ratified, and it still isn't complete. And you know, these are things that need patience, time. And I think most of all, and I think this is, you know, one of the lessons of Madam Prosecutor, an assertion of will. Because if you allow those leaders who are involved in the blood diamonds, who are involved in the metal trade from Eastern Congo, who are leaders of extremist political organizations like the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, if you allow them the impunity, they'll continue to take it. And these days, with the weapons that are available very cheaply, it will only make life worse for everybody. This is one thing that can be done to insert a deterrent factor in the decision-making equations that these leaders really make. They do figure these things, the risks and returns, in their decision-making, and maybe draw them back from committing the really big crimes.
Well, Chuck Sudetic, on that note, I think that we can complete our interview. I wanted to thank you so much for joining us here today at KBOO. You are the co-author of the book, Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. And I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Linda. It was my pleasure.
University of Illinois professor Francis Boyle is recognized here and abroad as an expert in international law and human rights. He has served as a counsel to Bosnia and Herzegovina and to the provisional government of the state of Palestine. He was key in developing the indictment against Slobodan Milosevic for committing genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. I spoke with Professor Boyle earlier this week about the potential for prosecuting similar charges against former administration officials, including George W. Bush.
You argue that George Bush, Dick Cheney, and key administration officials should be prosecuted for crimes of war, crimes against humanity, and violation against domestic and international law. Can you give our listeners an overview of the crimes you believe the Bush administration is accountable for?
Certainly the most important and, I think, prosecutable would be torture in violation of the Convention Against Torture and the Geneva Conventions of 1949. There's a federal statute making torture a crime, and we also have the U.S. War Crimes Act of 1996 that are directly on point. And then in addition is the warrantless surveillance on the American people in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You know, in my opinion, those are the most important, together with murdering U.S. Armed Forces in Iraq. I was originally hired here to teach criminal law, taught it for a number of years, and still do criminal work myself. And murder is defined at common law as the unlawful killing of a human being with malice aforethought. And certainly with Iraq, that war was unlawful. Malice aforethought, well, I think we all know what malice is, malicious. Even Scott McClellan publicly stated in his latest book that Bush began to lie and concoct a propaganda campaign in the summer of 2002 to justify going to war. And then aforethought, namely they thought about it before they acted. And again, that's very clear, too. The decision made to go to war against Iraq, according to Snow, the first Treasury Secretary, goes back right to the very beginning of this administration, if not the Project for the New American Century report in September of 2000. So right now, the Bush administration, in my opinion, has murdered 4,260 members of United States Armed Forces in Iraq. These are our mothers, our fathers, our brothers, our sisters, our sons and our daughters. And it seems to me we owe it to them to go to our local state's attorney or district attorney and get Bush, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld, at least, indicted for murdering those dead U.S. armed forces from the territorial jurisdiction of the district attorney or state's attorney.
Is that simply the cut-and-dried process, then? Is it something that could happen? Also, what about the deaths of what is between 30,000 and 100,000 Iraqi civilians?
Well, I believe getting the indictment for murdering U.S. troops is something we can do, the American people. Indeed, we must do. All we have to do is find one district attorney or state's attorney in the country willing to convene a grand jury and present this evidence, the case I just briefly outlined, against Bush and the top hench people here. And I'm sure if the case were presented to a grand jury, they would in turn return an indictment for murder and conspiracy to commit murder. As for dead Iraqis, in theory, that could be prosecuted for war crimes, violation of the U.S. War Crimes Act of 1996. The problem there is you're going to have to convince the Obama administration to do that. and they're not even, you know, very enthusiastic about prosecuting Bush for torture. So if they're not enthusiastic about prosecuting Bush for torture, I don't see how enthusiastic they're going to be for prosecuting for killing Iraqis. But the point is, I think we can get them for killing Americans, for murdering Americans. And, you know, that's an important issue. We have to make it clear to all U.S. presidents that they simply cannot throw away the lives of men and women in U.S. armed forces for their own narrow economic self-interest, and that they will be held to account for this.
Well, what's the likelihood or the opportunity, I guess, for the International Criminal Court to step in and get involved with this, or the World Court for that matter, to pursue the issue of crimes against humanity and the crimes of war?
Well, right now I am preparing a complaint to be filed with the International Criminal Court against Bush, Cheney, and Tenet, head of the CIA, for the extraordinary rendition program. Enforced disappearances and torture. The problem in dealing with the International Criminal Court is that the United States government is not a party to the Rome Statute for the ICC. So the only way we could convince the ICC prosecutor, Moreno Ocampo, to go after them or at least investigate the complaint is to establish the jurisdictional basis under the Rome Statute. In this case, the jurisdictional basis would be that the extraordinary renditions and torture took place on, over, in, across ICC member states in Europe, such as Britain, Ireland, Spain, Italy, Germany, and the rest of them. So we establish territorial jurisdiction for these crimes, and that they were either widespread or systematic, which in my opinion they were both, to also constitute crimes against humanity. So that can be done, and, you know, I'm currently working on it now.
And so what happens with that then? Does the court issue a warrant, and then does the U.S. government have to cooperate?
When it's ready, I will submit it to Moreno Ocampo, the ICC prosecutor. He will investigate it, and then, you know, if he thinks a warrant should be issued, it goes to a judge there on the ICC court for vetting to make sure all the ducks are in a row, and then, yeah, they would issue a warrant. But that's way ahead of the game. Right now, I just want to set it up in such a way that he would have to open an investigation. The problem here is that the ICC prosecutor, Moreno Ocampo, in my opinion, just has no guts, no courage, and no integrity. A group of British lawyers filed a complaint against Tony Blair for war crimes in Iraq, and Britain is clearly a party to the Rome Statute for the ICC. It was a valid complaint, and Moreno Ocampo should have opened an investigation, and instead he refused. So I can't say I'm overly optimistic that we Americans can rely upon Moreno Ocampo to pull our chestnuts out of the fire here for us. You know, we have to prosecute our own leaders. And right now, I think the best bet is to go to your local district attorney or state's attorney and demand that he or she convene a grand jury for murdering dead U.S. soldiers in Iraq from the territorial jurisdiction of that state's attorney or district attorney.
So, Professor, but even with that kind of an effort moving forward, this administration has become very adept at balking at any kind of request and subpoena for testimony and information. What can compel them to testify and release information that would follow through with a complete investigation to where we would resolve this?
Well, if a district or attorney or a state's attorney, and again, the value of that, these are democratically elected local officials who are accountable to the members of your community, right? These aren't, you know, officials off there in Washington, D.C., who really couldn't care less what's going on in your local community. But once a grand jury is convened, They can issue subpoenas that are enforceable under the full faith and credit clause of the United States Constitution on a nationwide basis. And if they do not comply, they can have them arrested.
If this follows through, there are estimates that prosecuting top-level administrators, this could take 12 to 15 years are some of the estimates. Is that your understanding as far as the timeline? And then also, would that be a deterrent for pursuing this?
I wouldn't think it's going to take a district attorney 12 to 15 years to prosecute Bush and the rest of them for murder. I think they would convene a grand jury, present the case, issue the indictment, serve the indictment, and then, you know, start the trial. So I don't see why it would take 12 to 15 years. It would take probably as much time as an ordinary murder trial might in that particular jurisdiction. Who knows how long Moreno Ocampo will take, right? That's why I'm recommending we go to the your local district attorney or state's attorney.
Senator Patrick Leahy is proposing a truth commission to find out answers on all of these issues. What are your thoughts on this? Do you think it's just political theater, as it's been criticized, or could this really be a conduit for bringing justice?
Well, of course, I'm all favor for bringing the truth out, but not as a substitute for justice. And so it's hard to say precisely what Senator Leahy's end game is from this particular proposal. I don't know. I'm not casting aspersions on his motivation one way or the other. But if it becomes a something along the lines of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa,
which I think is patterned after,
right,
actually.
Well, that you go in and tell the truth and then you get amnesty,
right.
That's unacceptable. The Convention Against Torture and the Geneva Conventions, at a minimum, demand prosecution. That's a legal requirement of those conventions. That simply cannot be avoided or voided by means of some Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But, you know, if we have something like the church hearings on the CIA and the truth is brought out, and, you know, then that's used for a basis of prosecution, criminal prosecution, fine. But you really can't give people amnesty, certainly for torture and war crimes. That's what they tried to do down in banana republics in Latin America that, you know, everyone has scoffed at.
So if, as the Bush administration officials and Republicans have maintained, that the steps taken, in particular wiretapping, surveillance, extraordinary rendition, detainees, if those steps were taken in the interest of public safety and national security, is there any argument to be made then that the current laws and constitutional interpretations are out of date with the times? Because that's going to be, or that is the defense of the administration, to say these steps were absolutely necessary to protect the nation.
No, you know, that's just baloney, these arguments that they were making. I mean, if they want to, sure, they can go in front of a jury and make those arguments. I have no problem with that. I do criminal defense work myself. But the appropriate place to be making these arguments is in front of a jury, and not to avoid prosecution in the first place, which is mandated certainly for torture and war crimes and violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act at a minimum, and I would also say for murder. What possible defense could they have for murdering 4,260 U.S. troops in Iraq? I guess they could say it's necessary for national security, but where? We know it was a lie that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. It was a total lie right from the beginning, and everyone knew it. You know, we in the peace movement, I remember debating one of these top Republican honcho lawyers, Rifkin, on this issue live on Pacifica Radio Network, saying it was all lies. This is in the fall of 2002. And he said to me, so, Professor Boyle, you mean to state that the president is lying, the vice president is lying, the head of the CIA is lying, the national security advisor is lying, the secretary of defense is lying, and the secretary of state is lying? And I said, yes, they're all lying. Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction, as determined by the International Atomic Energy Agency and also by the UNSCOM inspectors, later the Inlovic inspectors, and we've been through this before in Vietnam. when all the Nixon and Johnson officials lied, and 3 million Vietnamese were exterminated, and 58,000 men of my generation were murdered. So, sure, let them make these arguments before a jury. I don't think we'll have any problem refuting these arguments on the basis of the documentary record and subpoenaing people like McClellan and others to come in and testify. These people were lying and they knew it.
So how far back do we go, and what kind of legal ramifications does this open up? This hasn't been done before, correct?
Well, it has been done before in other countries. Pinochet, Milosevic in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. I was the one who convinced the ICTY prosecutor, Carlo Del Ponte, to indict Milosevic for every crime in the ICTY statute, which is similar to the ICC statute, for what he did in Bosnia. And Milosevic was on trial in The Hague for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide when he, you know, he died for health reasons. Charles Taylor, former president of Liberia, is on trial in The Hague. So there are precedents here, yes. We tried 2 years ago to get Bush when he was up in Canada and to proceed against a sitting president. You need the consent of the Canadian Minister of Justice, and he wouldn't give it to us. But our report is Bush is going back up to Canada on March 17, and we're going to try to get him again. And this time, he is not going to be a sitting head of state. Kissinger is reported to consult with his law firm anytime he travels to make sure he doesn't get indicted and apprehended. Oliver North is the same thing. It's also reported for what he did in Nicaragua, exterminating 35,000 civilians down in Nicaragua. Kissinger has to be very careful where he goes, and Bush too. And we're going to do the exact same thing to Bush, Rice, Rumsfeld. The attempt was already made to get Rumsfeld in Belgium. But the bottom line is we Americans cannot rely upon foreign courts to pull our chestnuts out of the fire. We have to indict our own war criminals and prosecute them ourselves.
Thank you, Professor.
Sure. Thank you very much.
503-231-8187. Please give us a call and share your thoughts and opinions about this interview and this topic. You were just listening to Professor, Law Professor Francis Boyle. Joanne, this is a fascinating interview. I think Professor Boyle really presents some interesting arguments. But one of the things that really strikes me as highly unusual and highly difficult is this idea of prosecuting Bush, former President Bush, and Bush administration officials for the murder or the alleged murder of over 4,000 U.S. troops under the idea that he should be charged for murder, which, as he defined, is malicious killing of a human being.
He talks about, you know, the President of the United States, the Vice President, top cabinet officials as common criminals. I mean, he brings it down to a level that's much more personal for people and puts it in the framework of murder as opposed to war crimes, which can be far more abstract for Americans and not having so much experience with this. So it is a different approach, and it is extreme. You know, I think there'd be a lot of arguments on either side on really if it's practical. His argument that you could just haul them into court, you know, get a subpoena, you know, go through the process that you would for anyone who happened to break into my car this weekend. And I just think it's an approach that I'm sure a lot of people might not agree with. But I think in the sake of conversation, though, it is very interesting to hear it put in the sense of common criminals for these actions and how other people would be held accountable and how we have to really look at ourselves and how we're going to treat a president or someone at such a high level differently with regard to what we might consider the same crimes.
I think probably the most important point, or the point I liked the most of what he made, was that it's going to be us in the United States who have to take the lead in this. And right now there seems to be a particular window. I don't think it's a very big window, to be honest, because I don't think the Obama administration today is really renouncing these kinds of actions. Today they announced that they will continue renditions and that they're keeping the Bagram prison open, which is under much fire from all around the world for the torture and torment that goes on there. Many are afraid that if they close Guantanamo, it's only to move those prisoners who are already so damaged into that setting. So I do think, though, we have a moment of time. People were furious at the Bush administration. I have in front of me a letter that was just put out on 2 days ago, and it's signed by the Center for Constitutional Rights, the National Lawyers Guild, After Downing Street, American Freedom Campaign, The Nation, a list of like 50 different organizations that are calling for Attorney General Eric Holder in the Obama administration to appoint a nonpartisan, independent special counsel to immediately commence a prosecutorial investigation into the most serious alleged crimes of the George Bush administration and those party to it, including the attorneys who wrote up the famous torture memos. Well, that all of these organizations came together and put out this letter now is, I think, important. And I also have here a newspaper put out by Veterans for Peace called the War Crimes Times. So I think there's a window and there's a will among American people. Whether or not that will carry us far enough is hard to say. And at what point does the Obama administration actually become culpable for war crimes if they continue renditions? Will they ever want to release those secret emails? Who knows?
Well, we'll have to wait and see what happens. We're coming to the end of the show. Thank you very much, Joanne and Linda, for your interviews. I thought they were fascinating, provided a really interesting source of for the discussion. Join us again next time for another edition of With the People, last Thursday of the month at 6 o'clock. And I want to thank our engineer, Rebecca, Patrick, our co-host, co-producer, as well as Joanne and Linda. I'm your host, Alejandro Corral. Please remember to send us emails, wtpkboo@gmail.com, with your comments and suggestions for other shows. And visit our website at kboo.fm/with the people. Till next time, take care.
The KBOO Community Calendar for Thursday, February 26th. Oregon's economic outlook will be the topic of the City of Beaverton's annual lecture series, The Forum of Beaverton, Connecting People and Ideas. The second lecture in the series takes place tonight and will feature key state and local economic leaders and focus on the impact of the changing economy to our community. Tonight's lecture will start at 7 o'clock p.m. and will take place in the auditorium of the Beaverton City Library, located at 12375 Southwest 5th Street in Beaverton. The lecture will feature a panel of guest speakers that include State Senator Suzanne Bonamici, State Senator Mark Haas, Patrick O'Clair, City of Beaverton's Finance Director, Linda Moore McCoy, Mortgage Expert and President of National Academy of Financial Literacy, and Mark Ellsworth, Regional Coordinator for the Governor's Economic Revitalization Team. The lecture will be followed by a question and answer session. There is no admission charge and refreshments will be served. Seating is general admission and limited. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. For more information, please call 503-526-2243. That's 503-526-2243 or visit the web at beavertonoregon.gov. And to explore yet another facet of the economy, Speaker John Settle, Associate Professor of Finance, SBA at Portland State University, will be giving a lecture on Friday, February 27th from 1 to 3 p.m. entitled, The Economy, Whence, Whither, Huh? Sponsored by the PSU Working Group on Social Sustainability and the Center for Professional Integrity and Accountability, Professor Settle will describe his ideas on some of the behaviors that led up to this crisis. And attendees can collectively try to guess what might happen and can join together in a conversation about it within the context of social sustainability as a backdrop. Again, this lecture will be held tomorrow, 1 o'clock p.m. at Portland State University, Education Building, Room 212. Enter from the outside door. door on Southwest Harrison at Broadway in downtown Portland. For more information, call 503-725-4876. That's 503-725-4876. The Regional Arts and Culture Council is offering professional development workshops for artists in all disciplines who reside in the Tri-County Portland region. These workshops are offered as part of RACC's commitment to provide relevant and affordable learning opportunities that help artists become more successful in their careers. The next workshop, entitled Artists Wanted, Public Art from A to Z, will be held this Saturday, February 28th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., at the new Columbia Community Education Center that's located at 4625 North Trenton Street in Portland. Applying for a public art commission can be intimidating. The goal of this workshop is to demystify the process. RACC's public art managers will walk workshop participants through the process of applying for a commission from the City of Portland and Multnomah County. Workshops fill up fast. Sign up now. For more information and to register, visit the web at racc.org. That's RACC.org. And this has been the Community Calendar. I'm Alicia Olson for KVOO, listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, the Columbia Gorge, and Corvallis.